This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, Whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more five-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain.
As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. Today on the show, we welcome Allison Goh, who is a product manager at Facebook and formerly at Amazon, working on Audible. She shares some of her favorite product stories, which are must listens. And we talk about her team at Facebook, what skills it's comprised of, how they push product forward while continually pushing their team for new and innovative ideas. It's an excellent talk today, so stay tuned. Welcome to Rocketship.fm. In season 4 of Rocketship, we are diving into everything product and growth.
Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective.
We're your hosts, Michael Sacca
and Mike Belsito.
So I'm Allison Goh, and I'm a product manager at Facebook. Previously, I was a product manager at Rent the Runway, so I ran the unlimited subscription business. Okay. And before that, I was a mobile product manager at Audible, which is a part of Amazon. So that was a really interesting time where I worked on getting Audible into the Kindle app. So really a huge, interesting product. Before that, I was actually at a tiny, tiny startup called Open Air Publishing. And first employee, literally working out of an apartment in New York where we, you know, like just turned out digital books. It was really, really interesting. Yeah. Before that, I have an MBA from Wharton, and I was a journalist, actually, as my first career.
Yeah.
So very interesting transition, more in common than you would think. I probably write more as a product manager than I did as a writer, which is like very, it's great that I can still use those skill sets that I got when I was a journalist.
If just before we get into the rest, Ty, who we just interviewed, is also at Facebook, also has a journalistic background. I'm curious, Because there's the interview skills, there's the analytical skills, and then there's the writing skills as a product manager. Do you feel that was a natural transition into a product management role, or kind of what was that like for you going from the journalism world to the tech or product world?
Yeah, I think they're very, very much related. Journalism, you see some of the best product managers, I think, come from journalism because you have that communication background. Written and verbal communication is so critical. Yeah. And I also think the other part that comes into play is this ability to dive really deep and ask questions. It's very natural to ask questions as a journalist, obviously. That's like what you do all day. But when you're a product manager, you're also asking questions. Now you're not interviewing people for a story, but you're asking like, why does it work like this? Why are we doing it like this? Preferably you're doing it in a way that people like, it's friendly and you know, like people want to tell you the answers. But if you can't ask those questions and you can't dig and do those follow-ups, it's very difficult to do your job because you don't really have the baseline information to make decisions, right?
Yeah.
So I think that is almost as important as just the raw ability to communicate clearly your ideas and what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's both parts.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. No, it's interesting. And a connection really just kind of seeing it's mm-hmm. it's fascinating. So let's talk a bit about the role of a product manager. What is something that people may get wrong or generally get wrong about it?
Yeah.
I think there are two parts of what people get wrong about product management. So the first thing is the folks who come in and they want to be the next Steve Jobs. It's like, and they come in, they have this like bold vision, and then everyone just does what they tell them, they're being told to do. That's just like not how that works in almost any company. It only works if you're like actually Steve Jobs. There's a couple other folks who are founders of really visionary type companies. But if you are a PM, basically anywhere else, that's incredibly untrue.
Yeah.
I think the phrase that best sums up product management is this phrase like influence without authority. So no one reports to you. No one has to do anything you want them to do. You have to convince them to do it.
Interesting.
And sometimes it's a big, bold, like, you know, like you're like, this is what we're going to do, and like, you're going to follow me. But a lot of other times it's like listening and having a lot of empathy, and it's taking their inputs and incorporating it into the product is actually, one, they're like valid inputs.
Yeah.
But two, it gets everyone bought in to the thing you ultimately build. So I think when people come in and they just like have an idea, but you ask them like, how do you work well with others?
Yeah.
And they're just like, what are you talking about? You're like, okay, that's not really what the job is, right?
Right.
The other thing I see, you know, I'm part of a lot of communities, product communities, and there's just like a lot of questions about tools and agile and like, how do you set up this process perfectly? And I think that is a red herring often. I think process should serve the people that are on your team and the particular product and your certain goals, and also the company itself, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's sometimes this focus on what's the right tools, like should I use this brand or that brand? And I think it misses the point.
Yeah.
And it's not what product management is. Those are just, it's like, should I use Gmail or, I don't know, what other?
Hotmail.
Hotmail, right. That's like, it's irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is a distraction most of the time.
Yeah.
It's really should be about figuring out what your product vision is, and then who do you need on your team to accomplish it? And then the last part, right, is making sure the process is set up to enable that. But an example of a place where your cadence would be totally different and your tools would be different, it's like you can't really learn from other companies necessarily, is, you know, a Facebook, we move very fast. We, you know, have many people using the product, so you can make data-driven decisions very quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas something like a retail product that has a new product line once every 4 months is like working on a completely different cadence, and the tool that those tools are just going to be different. Like agile is not going to work necessarily because the company is working on a 4 month cadence, not a 2 week cadence, right? So to be obsessed with the process means you're not adapting to the actual product at hand.
Yeah.
So I think if you get down that road too far, that could be a huge problem.
How do you communicate, you know, when you're getting these different inputs, especially from teammates, right, who have a passionate idea, but you're kind of the gatekeeper, right, to getting it done. How do you communicate back to them the solution or the fact that you are including their idea in some part into the work?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing is, I mean, the way I start every conversation is with the assumption that, let me back up.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of this, the differences in opinion often come from differences in the baseline of knowledge.
Okay.
Right? So I, as a product manager, have a view of one set of things, maybe everything. That's maybe the core job of a product manager, whereas any other function may have a portion of it. And so their opinion is very much informed by the portion that they have. And so, if you do the thought exercise of assume the best intentions, like often it's because there's like a gap in knowledge, not because that person doesn't know what they're doing, but because like they inherently don't have the visibility in this other side of the business or the other side of the workflow. So I think that's where that's my assumption usually.
Right.
And then I try to dig into that and kind of figure out where that gap is. Like, why do you think this is important? What's driving that opinion?
Yeah.
And then if you can find that gap, you can then talk about the gap and not about the solution that is being asked for or like proffered, right?
Yeah.
So it's once again, it's like coming back to the digging in. And then once you get there and you say, well, now that you know this new piece of information that I had, do you still think the same thing? Now, sometimes a person might. And so I don't know if I have a solution for that. But usually, like, you come to a point where, like, we just have a different point of view of, like, what we're optimizing for at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, such a key question. What are you optimizing for? And if you can apply that to almost every situation where it seems like you're off with a person, it's usually because you have a different optimization or you have a different set of information.
Yeah, and that was assuming the best intention.
Always, right? Yeah.
I like that a lot.
I think, like, that's a phrase that's used a lot, and it sounds very kumbaya and like very like, oh, like let's all get along. But to me, it's actually like a completely mechanical thing that's like super useful.
Okay.
In which you, if you assume the best intentions, it means something else is why you're in conflict. And sometimes it's a different goal, but sometimes it's bad communication skills, and that's like also painful. But it doesn't mean that this person is out to get you or like is sabotaging you or just is like a terrible person. It just means like you either have different goals or you have different communication styles.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's you who has the bad communication style. It's like totally possible, right? So like you should, and so when you use the phrase assume the best intentions, it means it gives you a guidebook of like how do you work through what seems like a conflict.
Yeah.
It's so rare, like it doesn't have to be, I think most conflicts can be either avoided or like approached in a non-personal way. But, and you still might not agree because like your goals are just in conflict and that's okay, right? But there's a different way to solve that problem than just being like, this guy sucks, right? Which I think a lot of that often happens in the office.
And it's also.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show.
So let's talk a bit about what's been the hardest problem that you've been tasked with as a product manager, the toughest problem for you to solve, and how did you approach it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I mentioned earlier that I worked on a product in which we merged, or not necessarily merged, but we brought the functionality of audiobooks into the Kindle app, right? And that was a very difficult product because it was just big and involved a lot of people and a lot of people with conflicting goals.
How many people are we talking?
So at the end of the day, if you include all the engineers, I was probably dealing with like 50 people.
Wow.
At the same time. And so it was really interesting. But, at the end of the day, we have a mutual interest. We're all part of the same company. And we have a mutual interest in building the best products out there, right? But at the same time, Audible, we care about audiobooks, and Kindle cares about Kindle to some degree. And there's, like, a large overlap of adjacencies and things that we both want.
Yeah.
But there's like a sliver of things that we're like, we have a different revenue number and they're not necessarily related. Or,
okay.
This is very common in big companies, right? And also like to some degree, like the product philosophy can be very different when you're even within the same company.
Yeah.
So it was a really, really long challenge of digging into the differences and trying to bridge the gap between like how can I tell the story of what we're trying to do with the story that the Kindle folks are trying to do.
Okay.
And I think that it was challenging because the overlap was much smaller, and so you really had to like narrow in on that part
right.
to then be able to move forward.
Okay.
And it was super immersive. It wasn't just like, okay, like this is gonna work. We had to like pixel by pixel make decisions together. Me and like the other product manager working on that who was like, you know, we're concerned about the fidelity of the Kindle app because, you know, they have goals to make sure the whole thing is cohesive. It makes sense. And, you know, ours is like, let's get in there.
Yeah. Were you bringing the Audible branding in or more the audio experience?
The audiobooks. Yeah.
Okay.
So the way the product works, it's called Whisper Sync for Voice. And if you own both the Kindle book and the audiobook, you can like listen and read at the same time or switch. And so you can be sitting on your couch and read the book. And then you like get up and you go for a run. And you can listen to the book and it'll pick off where it left off. Right. And so the ultimate of this was to have it all in one place, with the full functionality of both experiences.
Yeah.
But once again, it's interesting because it's like, it's a complex product already, Kindle, right? And you add like this whole other media type in there.
Right.
And how do you do it without disrupting the Kindle experience, but also giving you the fully fledged Audible experience?
Okay.
While like, you know, VPs and like everyone and everyone cares at the same time. So there were just so many stakeholders involved.
Yeah.
So you actually had to build the product while also managing a lot of stakeholders.
Did you build a story around it? Like that story of someone reading and then going out running. Was that how you started to get people on the same page?
Yeah, and I think everyone what's interesting was everyone was on board with it at a high level.
Okay.
It was the devil was in the details, right? We, as Audible, we actually do want to maintain our brand identity to some degree, but that actually doesn't work in a Kindle app that has its own kind of brand identity.
Yeah.
So we had to figure out how to merge those two things together. Because at the end of the day, like they're two different parts of the company. But like at the very high level, everyone was in agreement that this would be a great experience. So that part, at least I didn't have to do that part too. Oh my God. but so that was a given. But then it was just like, but you had just enough of the goals being different that you had to really figure out the details. Like, should the button be here or here? Because if it was up here, that's like maybe breaking a paradigm that was already in the app, that kind of thing. And it seems so detailed and so almost trivial.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you are working on something that millions and billions of people are using, like those details matter.
Yeah. Did you do, what was the process like to get to the final released version? Did you do testing with users? Did you testing internally? What did that look like?
Both.
If you can share.
Both. Yeah. You know, the wonderful part about working at a big company is you have lots of free beta testers. So we have some power users inside the company, which is awesome. And so there's a lot of internal testing, less external testing. It's just something that you don't really get to do.
Okay.
And at the time, like this was like before the ability to do a lot of testing on app and like beta testing, it actually wasn't available yet.
Oh,
like Apple didn't even have it yet. It was like before that.
Yeah.
So like not the easiest thing to do, right?
Okay.
And I think when you work at a big company, it's like you're hesitant to put it out there without some guardrails. So we did a lot more internal testing. We did have usability testing, so you can bring an outsider and look at it in a very controlled environment. But it's like not the same, right? This is the kind of product where it's much better. Anything mobile is like you would rather have this person out in the wild doing reading and listening.
Yeah.
So there was a leap of faith there because in the early stages of mobile, you almost had to make several leaps of faith to get things out the door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the end result? Were you like when you released it, what was the result like? You know, what was the reception like? But also, how did you feel when it finally got out there?
Like triumphant.
Yeah.
No, it was great, and then it was very well received. It was actually like one of the we actually released the iOS and Android like out together, and like had a big. You know, party about it, and like, you know, it's like really the next step for that product.
Okay.
And the reception was great. I think one of the quotes that I use is like, so genius, it hurts my head. That sounds great.
That's a compliment.
I know. I'm glad I hurt your head. So it was a big deal, and yeah. And to this day, it's still an incredibly useful feature. What I love about it's funny because it's actually a while ago when I worked on this, but that product is really interesting because it's a wonderful educational opportunity. A lot of people who benefit from it are people who are learning English, have like maybe a learning disability, and like being able to listen and read at the same time is incredibly useful. Yep. And so being able to give that to people was like really rewarding. And so when you get it onto such a big platform like the Kindle app, that you get to hear the feedback, like, oh, this is so great. Like, it's really changed how I'm learning English. And like that is very fulfilling. That's one of the wonderful parts about working on a product like Kindle and Audible is like these products really matter to people.
Yeah.
And they're like so important to their day-to-day life.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet you can design it for the reader who wants to go on a run, mm-hmm. or someone who needs to learn a second or wants to learn a second language. That's great. So let's talk a bit about data and your gut. Mm-hmm. Where do you fall in this, and what do you tend to rely on? Now you're at Facebook and also Audible. I mean, massive amounts of data available. Mm-hmm. But where do you still lie in your decision making?
Yeah, I think that you need both.
Yeah.
The worst is to not have any data and completely work in a vacuum. I honestly don't have the chutzpah to go and like just build a thing because like that was my feelings for the day. Like
right.
I like those people, like that's great. But I really, really like data. So I'm a huge proponent of it. But I think it's limited, right? At the end of the day, you can have all this data and know what people are doing, but you still need to understand why they're doing it in that way.
That's
and you'll
right.
never be able to completely understand that without talking to humans,
okay.
right? So it's the combination of the human voice and what they're doing. And sometimes the human voice doesn't match what the data actually says. Like you go talk to 100 people and they say, this is what I want to do. And then the data says they don't do that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Humans are flawed.
Right.
Or like they don't know themselves even, which is fine. But like they should be working in tandem. Like I think at Facebook, we're very blessed to have a lot of people supporting the product org in any given product.
Yeah.
And we have user researchers and data scientists. And the best thing about it is when they work together and feed each other information, right? So a data scientist can see a weird behavior that seems anomalous and like interesting.
Yeah.
And then the researcher goes and figures out what that is.
Right.
Right? You can't do it with just data, or else like you're just going to be making wild assumptions. And people use your product in ways that you almost certainly can't expect.
Yeah.
And same in the other direction, when you see a behavior that is very consistent in research or you're out in the wild observing it, then you go look at the data. It's like, is this actually true? Because when you have a lot of data, sometimes the trends don't actually come up, right? Like you can't always mine them in a way that is usable. There's sometimes so much data. So the two in combination is super powerful.
Yeah.
And I think, for instance, Facebook does a really good job of understanding that and institutionalizing it in the product development process.
Okay.
And you don't see that in that many places. And so, like, it's really great to be working at a place that really values that. And I value both. Like, I think people tend to overvalue data or value it to the exclusion of user research.
Where you're just optimizing colors.
Yeah, and which I think is also valuable, by the way. Like, I think that's like an important thing to do at a certain stage of the product.
Okay.
Right? So if you're in a growthy stage, user research is actually still important in growth, but mm-hmm. like you can get away with just like trying a bunch of stuff and like being like, see what works.
Yeah.
But when you're in early stages of product, that like doesn't fly. A phrase that we use at Facebook every once in a while is like this idea of a local maximum.
Okay.
So basically, it's this idea. It's easier to visualize than to explain over but talking about it. But
mm-hmm.
it's this idea that there might be, you might be at the best the product can be in the way it is now. And every incremental improvement you do actually makes it worse or makes your metric worse, whatever you chose to be your metric.
Yeah.
But there's some other maximum, another peak that's like off in the distance that requires you to go down before you can go up. Right?
Uh-huh.
So you're on the local maximum, and that's maybe there's another maximum that's better, but requires you to take a big leap of faith. So if you're super, super data focused and you are going towards something that is bigger, but like your first little step is a negative move, then you're like, oh, we can't go in that direction, right? And that is like, That's where data can lead you astray.
Okay.
And so there's also something to be said about having a vision and having this isn't the world, the only part of the world that we can live in. And so I imagine, I wasn't at Facebook when we made the shift to mobile, there are many shifts that Facebook and successful companies make these big strategic shifts, but they almost certainly are negative in the short term.
Okay.
But you have to do them to survive in the long term. So
and
if you
it sounds
get,
like they encourage exploration.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How do you know, is there ever a way to know, are you walking off a cliff or are you just, you just do it, right?
Nope. I think that's where your partners and your user researchers and all those folks come into play, because when you, if you feel like you have a true understanding of what the end user is trying to do, those leaps feel less crazy.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
If you can, or sometimes it's a matter of, are you leaping too early? Because mobile, everyone could see mobile was going to happen, mm-hmm. but is it going to happen in 2 years or 6 months? This would have been years ago when you were having this conversation.
Yeah.
And that it can be scary if you're maybe too early too, right? Even if you know it to be true sometime in the future. So that it's hard. You sometimes have to, as we say at Facebook, you have to be bold.
I like that.
Yeah, though. But but there's a fine line between being bold and being crazy.
Right. Sure. Let's talk a bit about a product mistake. What has been, a product mistake that you made, you were sure was going to work, and it didn't.
Yeah. So I'll talk about the Audible days again. So I was in charge of the iOS app. And so this was around the time when Apple had their new fonts and they had a new look and feel. So we wanted to be modern, right? Yeah. We wanted to update the app so it matched that look and feel. Part of the thinking was if you have an old, crusty looking app, people won't want to use it, won't trust it even. And actually, what's really interesting is if you want to recruit people to work on your product, engineers, they're going to look at this thing. It has all the drop shadows or whatever.
Pseudomorphic.
And they're what is this thing? I don't want to work on this. So there's a little bit of that. And so we went through this exercise of modernizing the app, right? Or modernizing the look and feel. We didn't really change that much of it, the functionality. And the biggest one that was totally avoidable, I've made a lot of mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes.
Everyone does, though.
But one that was I look back at it all the time, and I'm just what was I thinking? Was we took the app was white and had like a gray kind of gradient to it, which was super pre iOS 7 or whatever version this change happened on. But it was white and gray. So what we did was we're gonna do a white background and no more gradients, and it's gonna be white and very clean looking, very modern. We launched it, and this is also when Apple doesn't allow you to do, you couldn't do phased releases. You had to just 100% you go out.
Another 7 days, right?
And so you just can't even test it. You can't even put it out into a couple people. You just have to go out. And so we made it, and it's so beautiful. People are going to love it. And turns out when you have a white app, that's really, really, really awful at night, right?
Right.
And turns out people use Audible at night a lot, and not only that, they use it before they go to bed. But the thing that really killed me was one part of our customer base or audience are people who long haul truckers, which makes sense.
Yep.
A lot of long haul truckers in Texas. And they end up driving through the night and they have their Audible app, and then it's a beacon screaming at them from their mount, and it's literally dangerous. It's dangerous for them because it's so bright.
Wow. Yeah.
And they dim it to the very lowest level, but it still doesn't help. It's too bright.
Okay.
And so these were just use cases that, me as a city dweller who uses it on the subway, didn't even notice that it would be bright in a dark. And I never listen to audiobooks at night because, before I go to bed,
and
that
you're
sounds
not a
so
long-haul
that
trucker.
Sounds so stressful to listen to an audiobook at night. So this is my universe of how I use Audible and use audiobooks. And so none of us picked up on this use case, right? And so no one spoke up and was hey, there's these people who might use it in this way. And so we put out this product, not, or this change, not thinking about all these people. So I think this comes back, seems like I'm a huge proponent of user research, but I really am, right? Because if we had a much stronger sense of who the user was and really understood their use cases fully, I feel like we could have caught this much earlier.
Yeah.
And what we ended up doing, like once we we made a night mode as a fix.
Yeah.
And so to test night mode, we actually blocked out rooms and made them pitch black to test if they were too bright. It's really funny. But it was that was so avoidable if we really truly understood the various use cases of the model. And that was on me, not really digging into that and just having a fairly myopic view of who our user is.
Right.
I know about our truckers. I know that that's a core audience for us. But then, I didn't really understand it at the depth where I'm but long haul, and they drive it. I don't have a car. I don't even think about driving at night.
No, you're in the city.
Night,
You're right,
It's bad. And so this is the case for, diversity. It's the case for having a team that, can speak up and say, hey, I used this at night. It was really bright. Maybe you should consider that. And so building that culture and really pushing people to speak up is also important. So understanding your user, and many of those people are going to be working with you, which is awesome. Being able to hear those voices, but as well as the voices out there that maybe you don't have a lot of visibility in your day to day.
How did you find out? What did truckers write in?
Yeah, they wrote in.
Okay.
They wrote horrible reviews on the App Store. And it was a really rough week.
Okay.
It was a bad week. And so we were like, oh my God, we have to fix this. So we made a night mode, which was actually kind of difficult. It was just harder than it sounds like it should be.
Sure.
But we had to do it ASAP because it was dangerous. I didn't want to cause an accident in the middle of Texas because the app is too bright. They wrote in. Audible is a big company. There's a lot of people. And when 10 people write in, it means 10,000 people are having that problem.
Right.
So we fixed it. We tried to fix it immediately. But it was just a big black eye I was how could I prevent this? I think really understanding those user personas. I know user persona is kind of this tool that feels goofy and it's a way you're supposed to think about your customers, but really it's just about understanding how people use your app as much as possible.
Right.
Because then you can avoid, you can think about these use cases.
It's not just an app, right?
Yeah.
It's an app on an apparatus flying through the middle of the night.
70 miles per hour in Texas.
Right. That's a very different design problem.
Really,
that's fascinating.
I felt very bad about that. But never again. I have not had a mistake like that since then. I mean, there are times, I think the other thing about going back to about being Steve Jobs and having this gut call is as you get older, I think, and more senior, you realize 50% of your calls are going to be wrong.
Okay.
And you don't know which ones, the advertising thing. I know my ads work, 50% of my ads work. I just don't know which ones.
Right.
You prepare yourself for these scenarios. I actually don't think you get more accurate as time goes along because products change and people change.
Yeah.
But I think being prepared for it and doing as much research as possible so that you don't have the catastrophe that I would... that's being dramatic.
But no,
it wasn't great.
It was just a misstep.
Yeah, and people, there's the trucker use case, but also just being at night, wanting to go to sleep and listening to a soothing audiobook.
Yeah.
Those people, it's waking up my wife next to me because it's so bright.
It's real.
And that's real.
Yeah.
That was a big one for me.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Where can we find you online and if we can?
I have a Twitter handle.
Okay.
I don't use it very often, unfortunately. I'm on Facebook, but I keep it pseudo-private.
You gotta do it.
But, I think I still have the emails up for Twitter, so if someone tweeted at me, I would probably still see it.
Yeah, okay, all right, good.
But I do read them if I get, but I'm not a very active person on it.
Sure.
I'm out there. It's not hard to find me.
I was just curious,
people manage to find me, so Yeah, and I don't have a very common name, so pretty easy to find. Yeah.
If you want to find out more about rocketship.fm, go to rocketship.fm. It's pretty simple, right? Make sure you subscribe to this podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, so you don't miss future episodes in this series. And if you like today's episode, tell a friend.
Or two friends, or a lot of friends. We would love it if you would spread the word. And when you can, go to rocketship.fm and scroll all the way down and leave your email with us. We'll let you know about upcoming episodes, but we'll also get you in on a Slack channel with thousands of other product people and all sorts of other good stuff that we know you'll be interested in.
So go to rocketship.fm and sign up for our newsletter. If you enjoy this content, leave us a quick review. Or tell a friend, or share the link on Twitter. Anything helps to get the word out about the show. We really appreciate it. We'll be right back here in just a couple days.